question. I'm not very good with math, so I'm not going to get up here and talk about a lot of statistics, but I will have a question for you, and hopefully you will think about it, and it will stay with you after this. A lot of times we talk about statistics a lot, and they're all great, and they're dandy, but sometimes we lose the faces behind the statistics, and so I want to ask you why. Tell me why you have chosen to die. Is there some excuse for your blatant abuse? Perhaps there is some misunderstanding for your lack of demanding a life that is better than this. One where you firmly resist being less than the average, seen as more than just baggage. Doesn't it make your skin boil when you think of the toil that our foremothers carried, the children they buried for you, who sit and sit and sit, for you who refuse to admit that you have failed to stand, who would much rather blame the man for your poor existence. You make me sick. Not you, not you, not you who stand, but you who just sit. When will you admit that you're tired of this? Why do you just sit? How much does it take to simply enunciate? To pick up a book, or are you afraid to look at how far you've not come? Is it easier being numb? Well, I'm glad you have that pleasure, that you don't have to feel the sting of that leather coming across your black backs like our fathers who carried sacks on those same tired, sweaty, beaten backs. How soon we forget the attack dogs that bit our fathers, our brothers, our sisters, our mothers. Have you forgotten the water hoses, the broken bones, the bloodied noses? Do your children know why their foreparents died? Or do they think they just left or died a natural death? They did that for you, and look what you do. You just sit. You know what? Forget it. There is no validating the abuses with your lame excuses. If you have chosen suicide, then who am I to tell you otherwise? I've got work to do. And as for you, it is up to you to decide. Will you stand with pride, or will you just sit? At My Brother's Keeper Incorporated, we don't just sit. We know that there are health disparities that are out there among African Americans, and we have to do something about it. And that's why we're here today. Despite recent improvements in the overall health of Americans, substantial health care disparities still exist among African Americans in the United States. We know this because African American women, our sisters, our mothers, our aunts, ages 35 and 44, have a breast cancer death rate more than twice the rate of white women in the same age group. And that's why we can't just sit. Because African American men, our fathers, our uncles, our grandfathers, have about a 60% higher incidence rate of prostate cancer than white men. What's the issue here? The issue is cultural insensitivity, and it's a major barrier that impedes the capacity of healthcare providers like us, those of us who go out every day and talk to the community. There is something that's called cultural insensitivity that we have to deliver our services adequately to meet the needs of African Americans. We know that African Americans are far more likely to rely on hospitals and clinics instead of personal physicians. Sometimes we don't have our personal doctors, and we have to go to the hospitals and the clinics. And we know that African Americans are 16% more likely to visit the clinics than 8% of the white Americans. And so it is important that we understand the culture of African Americans when we are providing health care to them. We know that there are barriers that are distinct and that are specific to the African American culture. And in order for us to provide better healthcare services as healthcare providers, we have to understand the barriers that we face as African Americans when we are seeking and receiving healthcare. There are economic barriers. We wonder why, if the services that we provide, and they're good services, African Americans don't take advantage of those services, even when they're free. Well, sometimes there are economic barriers that stand in the way of us accessing health care, even the services that are great out there. Sometimes we don't have insurance. Sometimes we're underinsured. Sometimes there are co-pays that we can't meet or deductibles that we can't meet. So even if the services are there, there are economic barriers that keep us from taking advantage of those services. There are also structural barriers. Those are barriers that are within that building, within our own facilities. We are planning programs out there, cancer prevention, CVD prevention programs out there, but nobody's taking advantage of them because of what's going on inside of our own facilities. How many of us have tried to get health care and the person at the front desk is not the nicest person that we meet? That's a structural barrier because I might have traveled miles and miles just to get there. I may have taken my last day off work just to get there, but that person at the front desk has met me with resistance, and so I leave, and I don't come back, and so maybe I don't get my mammogram that day. That's a structural barrier that sometimes we have to think about as healthcare providers, that we are the front desk, and we are the determining factor sometimes as to whether people are going to come back and take advantage of our services. There are also informational barriers that we talk about, and that is the information that you're providing to your target audience, be it African Americans or any other race or ethnic group. Is that information that they can use or understand? Sometimes we think because we have a lot of letters behind our names that we have to use information that makes us sound important. Well, we have to get out of our way. It's not about us. It's about the people, the target audience that we're trying to provide that information for. And so we have to make sure that it is culturally and linguistically appropriate so that they understand it. And then there are individual and cultural barriers, and that's what we're talking about here today. How culturally we need to understand the barriers, the traditions about African Americans that determine whether we are going to seek your services or not. What we recommend is utilizing a step-by-step approach to building cultural competence. And it's the most effective way to increase cultural competence skills among healthcare providers. This is not an overnight fix. It's not a one-time fix. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's a step-by-step process, and it takes time, and it takes dedication. What we do at My Brother's Keeper is we travel. We are a capacity building organization funded by the Centers for Disease Control, Office of Minority Health and Health Disparities, and we go around and we teach providers. It doesn't matter the color of your skin. It doesn't matter what culture you're from. We try to help you understand the African-American culture and how it affects whether we are going to seek or receive your services. This is a one-day interactive skills building course, and it's based on the cultural competence continuum that goes from cultural destructiveness all the way to cultural proficiency. And I'm going to talk about those steps so that you can understand when you are talking to your African-American counterparts or your clients how to move or how to understand if you're being destructive or if you're being proficient. The objectives of the course are to provide healthcare workers with the necessary skills needed to recognize health-related benefits and practices of African Americans. We also want to give you this information so that you can improve the quality of services delivered and to finally understand the vital role that cultural competence plays in reducing healthcare disparities among African Americans. When we talk about culture, we want to make sure that healthcare providers understand that it is a pattern. It's a pattern of human behavior that includes institutions of racial, ethnic, religious, or social groups. And you also have to understand the different thoughts, the way people communicate, the way they act, their customs, beliefs, and what they value, everyday values. Those things play a part in how they seek and receive healthcare. What does it mean to be culturally competent? Cultural competence is a set of congruent behaviors, attitudes, and policies, and they all need to come together to enable healthcare providers to work effectively in cross-cultural situations. Why is cultural competence justified? Why do we talk about cultural competence? Why do we spend so much money training healthcare providers and community-based organizations on cultural competence? Because the perception of illness and disease and their causes vary by culture. Not everybody defines health and wellness the same. And so we need to understand, especially as African Americans, what it means for us to be healthy sometimes means that we're not going to the emergency room. And so if we're not on our way to the emergency room, there's no need for preventive medicine. There's no need for mammograms. As long as we're not dying, then it's okay. So when you're building your programs, your cancer prevention or your cardiovascular disease programs or any programs that are unique to your organization, you need to understand how African Americans value themselves and how they think about wellness. Culture influences health-seeking behaviors and attitudes toward healthcare providers. There are some events that are unique to the African-American community that's going to determine whether they are trusting the services that you have, especially when it comes to clinical trials. We're not very trusting when it comes to clinical trials because of things like the Tuskegee study. Sometimes we're thinking that we're going to be guinea pigs. And so we're not very trusting of the services that you know are good for us, but we are still thinking about some of the past events that influence us taking advantage of those services. Healthcare providers from culturally and linguistically diverse groups are underrepresented in the current service delivery system. And we talked about earlier where African Americans are basically going to go to the clinics and the hospitals. But if you look at the representation of African Americans as doctors, physicians in the hospitals, that we're underrepresented. And that's why it's so important to educate other cultures on African American culture so that when we come to you seeking health care, then you understand some of the barriers that we're bringing to you as well. There are some healthcare assumptions that you need to understand when you talk about cultural competence. There are some provider assumptions. Providers sometimes assume that African Americans are uneducated, that we don't understand healthcare, and that's just not the case. They also sometimes say that we don't care about our own health, because if the services are free, why aren't you taking advantage of it? Because you don't care. And they also sometimes think that African Americans are lazy. Why don't you come to the doctor? Why don't you take the time off work? Because you're lazy. And if you don't care about your health, why should we as providers? But then there are some client assumptions. We talked about sometimes we think that we're going to be used as guinea pigs. We think that the providers don't care about our health because if there are screenings out there, why aren't you telling us about them? And sometimes they think, you just don't understand my situation. You don't understand all of the things. You don't understand what it took for me to get here today to the 6:15 appointment. And then I'm 30 minutes late, and now I have to reschedule my appointment. So you don't understand all of the barriers that it takes just for me to get here as an African American. There are some things that are specifically unique that you need to understand as healthcare providers. Don't turn the African American population away. Don't think that they're lazy or uneducated. We do care about our health. The cultural continuum, let's talk about that very briefly. We talked about cultural destructiveness all the way up to cultural proficiency, and let's see what's in between there. To be culturally destructive means that there's a blatant attempt to destroy the culture of a given group. It's intentional. You don't like that group. You don't like the way they look. You don't like the way they dress. You don't like the way they think. And just that mere presence means that you're not going to provide the best healthcare services possible to that group. And that is destructive. The assumption that one group is superior to another, that African Americans may be seen as inferior populations and other races might be seen as superior. And so you don't provide the best healthcare because you don't value another population as you do your own. And to be culturally destructive means that you acknowledge only one way of being and purposefully denies any other cultural approach. It's your way or no way. And you don't take into consideration anything else other than your way. And that is being culturally destructive. Cultural incapacity. An individual or organization lacks the capacity to be responsible to different groups but this is not intentional. And it's based on ignorance and unfounded fear. Sometimes we have the fear of the unknown, and that makes us make decisions that are not best for the people that we're trying to provide the services for. It's not intentional. It just means that we don't know, or we're afraid of the things that we don't know. And then failure to recognize when mistreatment is due to cultural differences and thereby perpetuating its occurrences. We're doing things that we don't know that we're doing. And if we don't know, then we continue to go down that same path until we learn something different. That's being culturally, that's cultural incapacity. Now, the next step is cultural blindness. This means that a blindness or ignorance of cultural differences. And what this really means is that sometimes we think, we try to pretend that everybody is the same. And we're not all the same. And we have to accept that we're not all the same. But when we can't be blind to culture. We have to accept it and we have to embrace it. It doesn't mean that we have to change how we are. It just means that we have to accept that other people are different than we are. And then we foster the assumption that we are all basically alike, so that what works with members of one group will work with all groups. And that's how we tend to lose people when we're preparing our, when we're marketing our services. Sometimes we use a canned template and we try to say that if we make it one way, then everybody will accept it, and that's not the truth. You have to understand your population. You have to do your needs analysis. You have to look at that community and understand what is important to them, and then market around it. You can't have a one-size-fits-all project. Cultural precompetence implies movement toward cultural sensitivity. Now we know that culture exists, and we know a little bit about that target population that we're trying to reach, and we want to be sensitive, and so we're moving toward cultural competence now. The active pursuit of knowledge about cultural differences and the attempt to integrate this information into the delivery of healthcare services and learning and understanding of new ideas is encouraged by our organization, and we're looking for solutions to improve our performance. And now we're culturally competent. We've moved from cultural destructiveness, where we just don't care, to cultural competence. We're trying to understand culture. We know a little bit more about it. And now we know that the African-American community has some unique situations that we need to understand, some cultures that we need to embrace, and that we need to, when we're providing our healthcare services, understand what they are and make allowances for them. And we need to accept and respect the differences. It doesn't mean that you have to change who you are, but you need to accept and respect that other people are different than you are. And there's a continual self-assessment. You always want to look when you're providing healthcare services to populations that are different than yours. What am I doing? If you have services and you know that they're great, you have a great program, but nobody's taking advantage of them, then you need to ask yourself, what am I doing? Is it that I don't understand that population that I'm trying to target? And then actively seek advice and consultation. If you are of a different population or a different race and you're targeting maybe African Americans, then you need to seek advice from other African Americans who are within that population because you want that population represented. And that means you are culturally competent. But the thing we want to do is we want to be culturally proficient. And in this stage, culture is held in very high esteem. Cultural destructiveness is not tolerated at all by any means in any organization. Cultural differences are regarded proactively, and improved cultural relations among diverse groups are promoted. We also know that healthcare providers are regarded as specialists in the field of cultural competence, and that they are developing culturally sensitive practices. We took this course and we piloted it to 7 community health organizations, and after we delivered this course, 75% of the participants strongly agreed that they were leaving that room with some additional skills that they didn't have when they walked in. 75% of the participants strongly agreed that their awareness about cultural competence had increased due to the course, and 87.5% of the participants strongly agreed that they could apply the cultural competence skills within the next 3 months. So if they walked in culturally destructive, doing things that would destroy the culture of another race, or if they walked in knowing that they weren't providing the best healthcare service that they could because they were culturally insensitive, they walked out building, having the skills, having the tools to build, to become culturally competent. Now, what's the goal? The achievement of cultural competence makes sure that we are treating our clients and our patients with respect. And that's what we really want to do. Everybody wants to be validated when they are seeking and receiving services. And that's what cultural competence means, understanding others' culture and just validating them and respecting it and providing the best health care possible. We at MBK have work to do, and I hope now that you have some skills that you can walk out with, some additional information that will help you to provide more culturally competent healthcare services to your communities. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Johnson. All right, and the floor is now open for questions and answers. We have about 15 minutes left in the session, so we'll start right here. Right away. Hold up one second. I'm going to also ask whoever is going to respond, please come to the mic, and if you could restate the question a little bit so we can get it on recording when you answer.
Okay, thank you very, very much. In fact, initially, I should have mentioned that this is work in progress. I'm still collecting information from the prisons. As you could have noticed, there are some areas.
What
I want to do, I know there's a standard mortality ratio and then comparing it to the standard population and then controlling for using the standard population of African Americans and then the population of those in jail. That's what they use. Now, time could not have permitted me to read some other things here. What we have is state prisoner mortality rates increase with age. The mortality rate of inmates 18 to 24 was lowest. Okay, and then among inmates 55 and older, the rate was 1973 deaths per 100,000, etc. And then 14% of state prisoners, but 67% of the prisoner deaths from 2001 to 2004. And more than 59% of the inmates age 65 or older who died in state prisons were at least 55. Or older when admitted to prison. So it's a work in progress that I am doing. But then based on this information. That is why I have that title. The title is that at least they are living longer than they are living than people who are outside. Now, the second point of your question is health is not the mortality is not the only thing about health status. But at the same time, I have in my discussion I have brought about the health disparities that we have compared to all the other races that we have, whites compared to blacks. So it's a given that when we look at health disparities, African Americans or black people are at a disadvantage compared to whites. So that's a given that we know. And then,
yeah.
Yeah, okay. One other thing about mortality is that, as it may sound like being insensitive, mortality is a very, very good measure. You are dead or you are not dead. Okay, so when you do research on mortality, it's a good measure. For example, I may say, okay, I'm sick or I'm not sick. Sometimes there's a line, a blurry line there. But mortality is a good measure to know about health status, even though it is not the only measure. But then if people are not dying, or before people die, then something will have happened. Okay, we have violence, and then we have death through sicknesses. So if our population is not healthy, we are more likely to die compared to the people who are healthy. It's a given fact of life. I hope I'm able to... Well, you may be right to some extent, but then they look at the data from 2000 to 2004. So that's a four-year span. Of course, this we may call this a cross-sectional study. We may not say that will be sustained over time. But then my presentation is that the reason for my presentation is that I want us to talk about it, to have the dialogue. Okay, if even one is too many. Okay, so we're talking about 2000 to 2004, 4 years, and then people who are outside are living shorter. Why is that happening? And I've hypothesis. I've given a couple of reasons why I personally think so. But then I've not conducted any, let's say, prospective study to follow African Americans or black people to say, okay, this causes this. But then at least there is an association, and that's what I want to just bring out. Where from, please?
I'm from California.
Okay. Yeah, California space was a little bit blank. I've not yet filled it in. But even that, even if they are not getting it, let's say if I have hypertension, I have serious headache in California prison, at least I'll get medication for my my headache. But if I'm... Okay.
I just want to interject because we do have a couple of other panelists, and I'm sure that other people have heard it. I'm sure that Dr. Salar would love to discuss this more, and it sounds like this presentation is more of a hypothesis-generating discussion that maybe people can actually explore. So I'm sure he can make himself available to talk about some of these issues in a minute. Someone else had their hand up over here.
Actually, I wrote it, and it's not published.
You need to do that.
Thank you.
Also, given the topic of this session, I was curious to know if My Brother's Keeper does anything with cultural competence when you're dealing with ex-offenders or current inmates. There's a growing population, but also a growing push to get more healthcare workers involved in the correctional system.
Well, we don't specifically do anything with inmates, but our project is all-inclusive of African-Americans, and actually not just African-Americans, but any population who's interested in understanding the African-American culture. So it's not, if there are inmates or there are facilities, correctional facilities, who are interested in us coming to talk to them about cultural competence, that's something that we can definitely do. We don't exclude any institution from gaining the knowledge of cultural competence. That is something we can definitely consider, and what we do is provide technical assistance for people or institutions or community-based organizations who are interested in tailored cultural competence curriculum, so that's definitely something we can talk about.
I know dealing with our learning laboratories, a lot of their interventions were grant funded, so they received funding. Well, our Community Voices is in the National Program Office for this, for their learning laboratories, so they did receive funding through us. But other jurisdictions as well, for example, I mentioned Prince George's County, Maryland, that they have a resource center, and a question of funding also was, I think, part of that is in their planning, and they did also get, I believe, grant funding as well. What I'm finding is that for organizations that are able to move into this direction, that they are able to get certain type of seed funding and build upon that. And then also it really takes a lot of buy-in for all different components, the community, corrections, social services. And so the challenge is, when it comes to looking at, are you going to pay now or are you going to pay later? And it's just educating the community and those stakeholders that are involved with how, by doing these interventions at this point, it will save you way down the line when it looks at the cost of incarceration, also the cost of people returning back to their community and not having any type of health care or health services. I hope I was able to answer your question somewhat. Thank you.
Anyone else? I actually have one or two questions. Actually, Dr. Johnson, I'll start with you with this question. You mentioned the Second Chance Act, and the first, oh, I'm sorry, not Dr. Johnson, but Dr. Williams. You mentioned the Second Chance Act, and the first thing that came to my mind was the three strikes and you're out. So I was just wondering, how does that fit in to that policy? And perhaps in this particular state that you were talking about, if there was a particular state with that Second Chance Act, were you talking about across the board in terms of community voices? Could you address, just expand upon that Second Chance Act?
Second Chance legislation is federal legislation that is being considered in the Congress at this time. I believe on the House side was introduced by Congressman Danny Davis in this session, and on the Senate side, I don't want to misspeak, so I'm not even going to, I can't remember correctly the senator who introduced it, but it's legislation that's looking at this whole issue of reentry and addressing some of these issues by providing grant funding to start some of these programs. As far as the three strikes and you out, this bill, I do not believe, addresses that. And I believe there are others who are working at looking at ways to address that. So I will not begin to speak upon legislative efforts looking at three strikes, you're out. There's also efforts, legislative efforts, looking at the whole law between crack and powdered cocaine. And there has been a lot of conversation in legislative and Hill circles regarding that. But with the Second Chance legislation, let me just say Community Voices, we're a nonprofit, so we do not lobby or support. We just provide information and educate. And one of the bills that we have seen come through has been the Second Chance legislation introduced in the Congress this session. However, in the past, there has been other bills introduced that do look at issues of providing rehabilitation and reentry services for those who return to their communities. Thank you.
Thank you. And looking out, question for Angela Johnson. Can you tell me what the difference might be between any, if there is any, in your view, difference between cultural competence and cultural confidence? I know as we have progressed over the years, and I noticed you used 1999 framework in terms of cultural competence. Can you describe any difference between that?
Well, I think the difference, in my opinion, between cultural competence and cultural confidence is cultural confidence is more so us taking pride in our own culture and understanding that there are subcultures within our culture and being prideful about those cultures. But cultural competence expands, and it expands into different races and different ethnicities, and it expands into organizations. And when we speak specifically about healthcare organizations, we're talking about cultural competence and understanding how African Americans seek and receive healthcare, and being knowledgeable and respectful of those differences.
And last question for you on that is, or for me, as I see somebody else has their hand up.
I just had a quick thought.
Well, go ahead.
Quickly, what about, for example, we can educate and increase the workforce, but if the organization is not receptive to the employees, how do you see people working on that end in terms of retention of communities of color that are employees? Because we not only have to serve the people, but not only do we have the people to serve, but we have to serve the people.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you see working with organizations in terms of EPO and retention of people from communities of color, their ability to do their job?
I think what we're doing here today is the beginning, and I think education, like you said, is the key. And making sure that we are consistently educating not only the people at the front desk, but the people at the higher levels, and making sure that they buy in, that because, you know, just because you're in a position doesn't mean that you're culturally competent or even culturally sensitive in a higher position. And so educating those people. And also it's key that when we're planning programs, that we have the people around the table in the planning stages who are culturally competent and who are educated continuously on the cultures of those who are participate in those services that are being provided. So I think education is the key on all levels and being consistent, because we talked about it being a process. It's not an overnight, one-size-fits-all. So it is a process, and it just means being consistent and being continuously educated.
Mm-hmm. So that probably require a
My Brother's Keeper will work with any organization, any program who is interested in developing cultural competence skills. It doesn't matter who they are. We, like I said, are funded by the Centers for Disease Control, and we're a national project. And that becomes technical assistance that we're providing for organizations who want to become culturally competent and culturally proficient. So we don't discriminate against any group who wants to build your skill level.